Ravoque took a third, leaden step. Vilna's mouth moved weakly. He made a wet, rattling sound in his throat. Ravoque closed his eyes and furrowed his brow with one final effort. Human Vilna turned inside out. It happened very quickly, like a sudden conjuring trick. There was a brief but intense noise of flesh tearing and bones fracturing. Then the psyker burst in a huge shower of blood and gobbets of meat. Ravoque breathed out and wiped a spatter of gore from his cheek. Stefoy could finally see a frail light ahead. The tunnel was pitch black, and he had already fallen twice and torn his hands and knees against the rough, salt-wet floor. The booming of the sea was louder now. He realized he could see a flight of stone steps leading up to a small door of metal bars. Back-scattered lightning was peeping in through the bars. Stefoy struggled up the slippery steps and fought to draw the rusty bolt and the bar door. Outside, he could see the breakwater wall, the sea crashing over it in huge clouds of spume, so white they seemed luminous in the night air. Rain was in his face, and wind. The bolt finally drew, and he swung the door out, stumbling through onto the gleaming black stone of the sea wall. The force of the wind nearly picked him off into the roiling sea, but he staggered on, shielding his face from the breakwater sprays that exploded rhythmically over the lip of the wall. Thunder boomed overhead. Stefoy turned to look at the lighthouse, 300 meters back, along the breakwater. Through the rain and the spray, he saw the dark, armored flyers hovering on stall jets around it. The probing beams of their stab lights, the amber glow of the fires now raging in the lower levels of the tower. Up ahead of him, a metal ladder ran down the landward side of the seawall. Stefoy clambered down it and started to run through the midnight landscape of derelict dry docks and ropemaker barns back towards the city. Ravoque turned away from the smatters of Vilna spread across the basement chamber and started to search the room with his mind. It lighted on something almost at once. He walked over to a heavy, padlocked coffer standing in a side alcove. A single unword blew the lock off. Ravoque lifted the coffer's lid and looked inside.
"Well, well,"
he murmured. There was a sound on the stairs, crunching boots. Without looking round, Ravoque knew it was Bonehart.
"Are we secure?" Ravoque asked.
Bonehart nodded.
"This wasn't Ravenna," Ravoque said. "It was a practicing cult with a hired psyker. Not what we hoped, but interesting nevertheless." "So where is Ravenna?" Bonehart asked.
"Hidden," Ravoque replied.
"Hidden better than we can see. We have underestimated his talents. Call the teams. Tell them I want at least one of these cultist bastards kept alive for questioning."
Bonehart did as he was ordered. "So what now? The Chief Provost won't be happy that we..."
"We'll get Ravenna for him," Ravoque said. "I believe I may have found a new way to do it. Help me with this."
Ravoque closed the lid of the coffer, and Bonehart took hold of the other end. Together, the two men carried it away across the basement, towards the steps. Behind them, ignored, the seer papers tumbled in the breeze, some of them burning. "Thonius," they read. Every single one of them. "Thonius. Thonius. Thonius."
Chapter 6. He taped the gauze in place, then peeled off his surgical gloves as Kara pulled her top back down.
"That's looking much better," Belknap said. "The wound's clean."
"Thanks," Kara said, and got to her feet.
Outside, in the shabby waiting room of Belknap's makeshift surgery, a man was singing loudly in a drunken slur, and other voices were yelling at him to shut up.
"Lively tonight," Kara said.
"Pretty much the same as usual," Belknap said.
"So, how are things?"
Kara shrugged.
"Difficult. Tense. The direction of our investigation has changed, and the work's tough. Not dangerous per se, but boring in the worst way. And a member of our team is overdue. Missing."
"That's not good," Belknap said.
"But I actually meant you."
"Oh."
"You didn't have to come all the way down to Formal J just to get that dressing changed.
I presumed it was a cover story so we could talk about the private matter."
Kara smiled.
"Oh, that. Yes, I suppose so."
She sat back down in the old barber's chair.
"The medication you gave me, I don't know if it's working or not. I mean, I don't feel particularly better, and in some ways I feel worse. I get tired very easily, and concentration is a problem. And when I try to sleep, no matter how tired I feel, I stay awake for hours. Could that be a side effect of the drugs?
Possibly, Belknap replied. It's going to be difficult to distinguish as we go along what are effects of your condition and what are effects of the treatment. Let's stick with it for a few days, then switch to another inhibitor if the fatigue is still an issue.
I need to be sharp, Kara said.
Of course.
Now more than ever. I was wondering if there was anything in there.
She nodded her head towards his modest pharmacy stock.
Anything in there that might be a little stronger acting?
Kara, if you want to stay sharp, then morphiates and pain masks are not what you need. You'd be better off managing any pain or discomfort. Anyway, the strongest thing I can prescribe doesn't come out of the cabinet.
Go on,
she said, brushing red hair off her face. Belknap smiled a little self-consciously. Corny, I know, but... Strong, positive thinking. Your state of mind can have the most extraordinary effect.
Well, of course I want to stay positive.
I'm talking about more than that. Belief.
He reached into his vest and pulled out the silver aquila that he wore alongside his old dog tags.
In wartime, call it courage. In peacetime, call it faith. In the guard, I saw men do amazing things, fight off infection, heal wounds, just because they believed. And I saw men die just because they didn't.
Well, I believe, Kara said. I mean, I'm no zealot. I can't actually remember when I last went to temple, but I believe in the God Emperor. After all, I've pretty much devoted my life to his service.
Oh, I know, Belknap replied.
And that's good. But it is easy to believe in him, isn't it? We know he's real, after all. The faith I'm talking about, the real faith, comes from the belief that he's watching us and has the power to transform our lives. Kara pursed her lips.
Well, I think I've always believed that, she said. But I've also always believed in expressing devotion to the Golden Throne through deed and duty. I've never been big on high mass and night song and all that standing up and sitting down.
Fair enough, said Belknap. But the ritual can be good, too. It focuses the mind on the act of belief. Devotion through deed is fair enough, but most of the time all you're thinking about is the deed itself, not the devotion. Making time to go to the temple reminds you it's just about the divine, about you and your relationship to the power above us all. Sometimes worship should be a choice, not a byproduct.
I'll take that under consideration, Kara smiled.
Belknap got to his feet, clearing away the torn paper packet of the dressing. That's fine. You asked my advice. In my experience, faith is the strongest medicine of all, especially in cases such as yours, where the illness is so...
terminal,
she suggested bluntly. He nodded. In such cases, there can be a measurable effect. Just through faith and positive thinking, patients have reduced painful symptoms, enhanced their quality of life, extended their expectancy, even... in rare cases, found remission. I mean to say they have survived cancers that absolutely should have killed them, because they believed the God Emperor was watching. And he was.
Right, said Kara, also rising to her feet. I'll stop off at the temple on my way back now. Light the taper. Say the Vobis. How's that?
That's a start. Two streets from here is St. Eldosis Understack. Small place, poor but honest. You could do worse. Kara shook her head.
Oh, no, she said. If I'm going to go to a temple, I want the full awe and wonder experience. I want heavyweight ecclesiarchy. The whole deal.
Well, Petropolis has more than its share of fine cathedrals and high temples, said Belknap. The Basilica Hierophantus in Formal B, St. Benedict's, St. Malchus in the square, tallest spire in the subsector. Falthaker Abbey, that's in C, very pretty. And, of course, the Grand Templum and the Ecclesiarchus in Formal A.
They sound about right, Kara said. Thanks. I'll come back and see you in a day or two.
She started to leave. Kara. She turned back and was suddenly face to face with Belknap. He reached up and unclasped the silver Aquila's chain from around his neck. Something to help you on your way.
That's yours, she protested.
Yeah, he said. Been with me since I was a boy. But I think it'll be content enough to come along with you. She put up her hands to lift her hair away from the nape of her neck so he could hook the chain in place. For a second, she felt the warmth of his hands and smelled the faint musk of his cologne. Then he stepped back.
Thank you, she said.
Outside, in the substack sink, Kara hurried along the underwalk towards the transit station. The night was bustling with people, and rainwater from the ferocious storm high above was drooling down through the sink levels. Kara pulled out her handbox.
It's me. I'm on my way back. Just a quick stop to make. I'll be an hour and a half. Any sign of patience yet?
No, I responded. I'll keep you informed. I closed the link and turned my chair back to the others. Patience was now almost 2 hours overdue. Carl was showing nothing useful on his data engines, and there was no response from Patience's handvox. Every 5 minutes, I had Frauke activate his limiter so I could look for her. But it was no good. She was either shielded somewhere, or... I didn't want to think about the alternative. Nail was getting impatient.
I'm going back, he said, getting to his feet.
Back where?
Carl asked.
The Ministry Tower, Nail replied.
We don't know she's there,
Carl said.
Checking his weapon and his vox link, Nail glared at him.
We don't know much about anything helpful at all, do we, Thonius? Which is friggin' ironic, given the stuff you know.
Lose the snide tone, you knuckhead oaf, Carl snapped. I'm worried about her, too.
That's enough, both of you, I said. Nail shrugged.
All right, but the one thing we do know is the Ministry Tower is the last place she was seen.
You're tired, Methuen said. I'm fresh. I'll go.
Nail shook his head. I've spent the day there, Zeph. Know my way around at least a little. Better if it's me.
I find myself agreeing with Carl, I put in. We don't know where Kiss is, so I don't know how you expect to find her in a place that size.
I don't. You're going to find her, Nail said. Don't know how, but you'll think of a way. And when you do find her, I'll be right there, ready and waiting to get her out.
With that, he left. We heard the main door slam shut.
Whiston, I said.
Let's try it again. Frauke activated his limiter. Patience, no reply. Patience, where are you?
Kiss opened her eyes. It was cold. She was lying on the ground, on her side. In front of her, just a meter away, the foot of a whitewashed brick wall. The floor she was sprawled on was tiled with glossy white squares. For a moment, she thought she was naked, until she realized she was wearing a thin gown of disposable paper, the type they sometimes give patients in infirmaries. Her feet and legs were bare. Her hands were cuffed in front of her, with heavy metal binders. She realized that the main reason she'd felt naked was because not a single erg of psi power existed in her head. Her talent was gone, as surely and completely as when Frauke did his blunting trick. She rolled over so she was facing into the room. A secure cell, definitely. Caged lights in the ceiling, a heavy gauge hatch in the opposite wall, a plain wooden chair on the floor next to her. Across the room, a man sat in an identical chair, facing her, his back to the door. He wore a simple, sober suit of dark grey with a black dress shirt. His pale skin was freckled, and he had slightly thinning red hair. As she rolled over, he reached a hand to his ear and activated what must have been a micro-bead comlink. She's awake. Then he remained sitting there, staring at her. After a couple of minutes, the hatch whirred open, and an identically dressed man entered. He was a little taller, a little heavier than the first, paunchy around the waist, with cropped dark hair and the flat nose of a pugilist. He carried a paper sack in one hand, and a small, stubby actuator wand in the other, which he waved to close the hatch behind him. The freckled man got up, took the wand from his colleague, and went to stand by the door. The dark-haired man sat down facing Kiss, and held out one hand to indicate the empty chair beside her. Kiss got up, unsteady at first, and sat on the chair. The man looked at her.
Things sometimes aren't what they seem, he began. At face value, they're one thing. But peer under the surface, and you find all kinds of secrets. Luckily, secrets are what I and my friend here deal in. Secrets. We're experts, you might say.
Kiss made no reply.
So you, the man went on, at face value, you're junior scribe Merit Yevins. You started work today in Administry Tower 3, Department G/F1, Station 86.
He reached into the sack and produced Kiss's permit.
Your documents check out.
They're not fakes or copies. We even ran them through the Informium. Merritt Yevons, that's you. So, what we appear to have is a junior scribe who became unwell after accidental exposure to a subliminal whilst working at her station.
Kiss just stared back at him.
But there's more to it, isn't there?
The man said. He put the permit back in the sack and lifted out the analyzer.
You were found to be concealing this. Data analyzer. Expensive model. That's odd, isn't it? Why would a junior scribe be transmitting data for analysis?
The man dropped the analyzer into the sack, rummaged around for a moment, and then took out Kiss's handvox.
Then there's this. Handvox. Common enough. So what? Well, this is odd too. It's new. It was purchased locally, not more than a week ago. And it's been altered. Altered by someone who really knows his way around tech priest stuff. No stored calling codes, which is funny because everybody stores calling codes. And it doesn't log. It's been fixed not to log. Outgoing or incoming, no codes get recorded. So, there's no way of telling who Merritt Yevons calls, or who's been calling Merritt Yevons.
He looked at Kiss for a moment, and when she made no reply, he continued.
So, we're really scratching our heads at this point. And then we find these.
He put the vox back in the sack and took out something else.
They were laced into the hem of your jacket. Thin blades, without handles, seriously sharp. That's a whole new level of odd. Then, one of my colleagues here, and I might point out at this stage that the people I work with have all kinds of specialist knowledge. Anyway, he says these are kine blades, designed for use by adepts with telekinetic powers. So we scanned you. You were unconscious through all of this, by the way. And lo and behold, the scan reads you as a telekine. What's more, the sort of telekine it doesn't pay to mess with. So I'm thinking it's very likely that you're not Merritt Yevons at all. Because Merritt Yevons isn't a trained combat telekine with access to these sorts of toys. Nor is she the sort of person with the expertise to persuade the Informium itself to lie about her identity.
He smiled.
We still don't know how you pulled that one. Incidentally,
he said, putting the kine blades away and handing the sack to the freckled man.
We inhibited you. You must be able to feel that. Standard limiters, even lockable ones, can be removed or tampered with. So we injected a fluid suspension of microblockers directly into your bloodstream. You won't be able to use your psychic powers again for at least another 12 hours.
He leaned forward, his elbows on his knees.
Do you have a name?
Do you?
Kiss asked. The man sat back and grinned.
All right, let's play. I imagined we would. My name is Selden. My pal here, his name is Braid. We are agents of the Ministry of Subsector Trade, though our agency is clandestine. We're called secretists. You're being detained in the secure wing of our headquarters. I tell you all this simply to demonstrate the hopelessness of your situation. No one knows where you are. No one is coming for you. Our powers of detention are entirely beyond administratum law, as are our methods of interrogation. You will never see the outside world again. You are not likely to live more than a day or two. Everything you are, everything you were hoping to achieve, it's all over and done with. Finished. The only thing you have left is the power to determine the quality of what remains of your life. Give us the information we need, and that quality will be relatively high. We'll take care of your last few hours in a way that you will thank us for at the end. Obstruct us, and when that end comes, I promise you'll remember this moment, and loathe yourself for making the wrong choice.
Do they train you in these techniques?
Kiss asked softly.
Or were you born a silver-tongued bastard?
The man was still smiling as he rose to his feet.
Girl, I make this crap up as I go along. Now, let me tell you what I think.
Please,
Kiss said.
I think there's a very good chance you're an associate of Gideon Ravener, the rogue inquisitor. We're very keen to speak with him. Actually, that's a lie. We're very keen to kill him in the most painful and permanent way imaginable. I know it must be very hard to contemplate giving up a friend, betraying them and their confidences. Ravener's probably your mentor, right? Father figure, beloved leader. But I tell you what, you'll be so grateful that you did.
My name is Merrit Yevons, Kiss said.
Salden pointed at her and winked.
I love it when they play hard to get. We can bring in a psyker any time. Rip the truth from your boiling skull. But I have a better idea. It'll involve a lot less mopping the floor.
He looked at the freckled man.
Braid, go get prisoner AA-15 and bring him here.
Braid nodded, waved the actuator wand to open the door, and left.
You're going to love this bit,
Selden told her.
Brace yourself. Don't make this too easy for me.
He took a palm-sized scanner pad out of his jacket pocket.
Biometric reader, he said. Set to register psychological changes like heart rate, pupil dilation, breathing fluctuations, and skips in synapse activity.
Truth reader, said Kiss.
That's right,
Selden nodded.
It reaction scans even non-verbal responses. Don't worry, it's not for you.
The hatch opened again. Braid re-entered.
In here, he said.
A small figure shuffled in behind him. He was shackled at the wrists and ankles, his depth of stride seriously restricted. His head was bowed. What was left of his uniform was torn, and from the bruises and dried blood caking his flesh, it was clear he had been severely beaten more than once in the last few days. Fresh purple contusions mottled older, yellowing bruises. Hideous gashes, each more than a week old, crusted the man's chest and shoulders. Something had been used to sever the fourth and ring fingers of both his hands. When he looked up, his face was a swollen black gourd of bruising and half-closed, bloodshot eyes. Even so, he was still recognizable. It was Shipmaster Sholto Unworth. His fingers steepled together, his chin resting on his thumbs. Orfeo Kalzean slowly looked up from the regicide board in front of him. The game was set on a little turntable, and Kalzean was tormenting himself. He rose to his feet. The hotel suite was quiet, except for a delicate sonata by Hans Solveig that Kalzean had left playing at low volume.
Hello,
he said.
I let myself in, said Taurus Revoke.
Kalzean recognized him instantly. It was the man who had gone head-to-head with the brass thief at the diplomatic palace.
I'm sure you did, said Kalzean. I've been expecting you, actually. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Revoke half nodded.
You are Orfeo Kalzean?
Yes, I am. You?
Taurus Revoke. You seem remarkably composed, Kalzean, considering your situation.
And what is that, exactly?
Kalzean asked. Precarious, smiled Revoke.
Would you like a drink?
Kalzean asked.
Perhaps an appetizer?
I'm fine, said Revoke. The little Simivolpa was hiding under one of the chairs, hissing at the secretist in pure malice.
Stop that,
Kalzean shushed.
So, let's get to business, shall we?
Business? Revoke echoed.
There is no transaction here. You speak like you have some leverage.
You do not.
I visited your employers at the lighthouse in Kew this evening. They are all dead now.
I expect so. You are a dangerous man.
Thank you. Their leader, Magus Clancular Cornelius Lazard, as he kept reminding us, remained alive long enough to tell me all about you. By the end, he was quite desperate to tell me, in fact.
Kalzean walked over to the sideboard.
Do you mind?
He asked. Revoke shook his head. Kalzean poured himself an Amasek, trying hard not to give away how much his hands were shaking.
You are a facilitator, an expediter, and you work for cult concerns such as the Divine Frattery, so long as they can afford your fees.
Yes, sir. That's what I do.
You make things happen.
Kalzean took a sip of his drink, breathed deeply, and nodded.
I have skills and means. If something needs to be facilitated, I'm the one people come to.
According to Lazard, the divine flattery was concerned with the birthing or manifestation of a demon called Slight, whose occurrence they had foreseen. They employed you to make this happen. The birth of this demon was tied into the activities of Inquisitor Gideon Ravener, who currently acts against my interests. So that made me and my commander, the Chief Provost. How did Lazard put it? It made us negative determiners. Is that right?
It is.
And that's why you unleashed an incunabula to kill the Chief Provost. Talzian took another sip.
Naturally. It was the most expeditious option. But you stopped it. I watched you. It was very impressive. I should like to know how you did that, Master Revoke. As a result, the determiners changed slightly.
Favorably, I gather. Lazard was quite clear that despite the failure of your attack, this Slight was quantifiably more likely to be manifested. Calzean set down his empty glass and shook his head.
Throne, sir, you really must have hurt Magus Lazard to get him to tell you this.
Revoke shrugged. I left it to the experts. I can tell you he was in 46 separated parts when he died. Calzean shuddered.
And that is going to be my fate too, Master Revoke?
You know, I should think so. The connecting door from the bedrooms opened suddenly, and Layla Slade came in. Orpheo, I heard voices, and... Her handgun was drawn in a nanosecond. Revoke was faster. With his telekinesis, he threw Slade against the wall, smashing a gilt-framed mirror, and seized her. Slowly, unwillingly, Slade raised the gun and aimed it at her own forehead.
Don't,
said Calzean. You're in no position to bargain, Revoke said. Calzean poured himself a second Amasek.
Actually, what do you know? I am. Don't let her be. I'm serious.
Revoke let Slade go and plucked her gun right across the room into his hand. I'll listen once, Calzean. Go on.
Well, here it is,
Calzean replied, taking his glass and walking over to the settee. He sat down, crossed his legs, seeming utterly relaxed.
His Magnificence Yeda Trice and the entire body of the Ministry of Subsector Trade, of which you are a servant, are engaged in some activity that... Well, let's put this fairly. If the Ordos knew what you were up to, they would purge this planet by exterminatus, just for starters.
He knocked back his glass.
So, by way of insurance, you understand, expecting you to come for me, I have prepared a document outlining all I know about your activities. This document is being held in trust by a third party, a major subsector banking house, just so you know. Every hour on the hour, I send them a ciphered message. All the while I do, they retain the document. If I miss just one cipher, the document will be sent directly, by Astropath, to the Inquisition on Thracian Primaris. I'm just guessing, but I think that would rather spoil your endeavors here.
Revoke said nothing.
So, this does become business. There is a transaction, after all. You tell me what you want, and I'll tell you what I can give.
Revoke turned and shot a mind nudge out of the room. A few seconds later, the chamber doors opened, and Bonehart entered, followed by four secretists lugging the coffer. They set it down and backed away. Revoke opened the lid. Inside sat the pyramidal device wrought of brass and the trigger orb. This is the incunabula you used against my master Trice.
Yes, it is.
It can find any target, anywhere, no matter how well hidden said target is. Calzean nodded.
That's what it does. The thief doesn't need an address. The warp shows it where to go.
I want you to use it to find and destroy Ravener, Revoke said.
And in return?
In return?
My payment, Calzean said. I want a piece of what you have. My terms are these. I will destroy Ravener, but in payment, I want Enuncia.
Revoke stared at him.
Yes or no, said Calzean. I want Enuncia. You've decoded the fundamental controls of reality. I want to share in that. Say yes, and I will operate this shining weapon for you. Say no, and you might as well leave now and watch your backs for the black ships and their virus bombs.
My answer is yes, Revoke said.
Excellent. That's business done. Now get the hell out of my chambers. I'll join you in an hour or so.
Revoke nodded to Bonehart, and the secretists carried the coffer back out. Revoke paused in the doorway. Any tricks, Calzean, and I will kill you.
I should hope so,
Calzean said,
with a dismissive wave of his hand. As soon as the secretists had left, Kalzean hurried over to Layla Slade and helped her to her feet.
"That was a lie, wasn't it?" she said.
"What?"
"All that stuff about ciphered documents held by banking houses. You never did that."
"A bluff, Lay, not a lie. They're quite different things."
"Whatever you say."
"What I say now is, let's unlock some of our other weapons, just in case."
Sulden waved the scanner pad at Unworth.
"You know," he said, "he's good. Not even a twitch of recognition. Unfortunately, the scanner says otherwise. A massive brain spike. Synapses firing all over the place. He knows you. He really does."
Unworth looked up at Kiss, his face a pitiful mess.
"I furnish you with all apologems," he hissed through his split mouth. "I never, ever intended to affect your betrayness."
"Don't worry about it," Kiss said. Sulden took out his hand vox.
"Revoke?" "Yes. It's me, Sulden. In the holding cells. Looks like we've got one of Ravenna's team here." "Yeah, locked up." "No, she definitely checks out. One of Ravenna's." "Absolutely." "All right. As soon as you get here." Sulden shut his vox and popped it in his pocket. He looked at Unworth.
"Get him out of here," he said.
Braid waved the wand at the hatch, and it opened. He jostled Unworth towards the door.
"One thing," Kiss said.
"What?"
asked Sulden.
"That subliminal you thought I'd picked up. I remember now how it sounded."
Patience Kiss looked Sulden in the face and said it. Chapter 7. It wasn't a word. It wasn't even so much a proper sound. Just giving voice to it made her mouth hurt. But it did a lot more to Sulden. He instantly, explosively vomited, then fell onto his knees, clutching at his belly, violently retching up his stomach contents. Kiss was already moving past him. At the open hatch, Braid was turning fast, drawing a handgun from inside his coat. Kiss slammed into him, driving him round against the brick wall of the cell. She grabbed the wrist of the hand holding the gun with both of her cuffed hands, and simultaneously smashed her left knee into Braid's kidneys. He grunted, back arching, and she drove his gun hand into the wall, scraping his knuckles along the rough, whitewashed brick. Immediately, he dropped the weapon, screaming out in pain. He tried to pivot, to swing her off him. Still holding his wrist, she shoulder-barged him face first into the wall. Sulden was back on his feet, closing, drawing his own gun. Kiss let go of Braid's wrist, clamped her hands on his shoulder for leverage, and threw herself out into a horizontal body spin. Her bare legs, scissor-kicking, whirled into Sulden, smacking his gun away across the cell and fracturing his cheekbone. He reeled backwards. But her hold on Braid was weakened. He clawed around, grabbing at her, catching hold of the collar of her paper gown. The left shoulder and sleeve tore away. Kiss kicked him in the belly, then grabbed him around the sides of the head with her cuffed hands as he doubled over. She delivered a sharp, vicious twist, snatching the force of it through her arms and her upper body, and broke his neck. Braid toppled over. Kiss had just enough time to duck as Sulden threw a punch at her and, knotting her hands together, drove a blow into his ribs. He staggered back against the wall, flailing out for her. With a growl, she sprang at him, hands outstretched like a diver. Her hands slid either side of his neck, and the metal binder linking them rammed into his throat, smacking his head back against the wall. Sulden made a silent, gagging noise, grappling at her arms. She pushed harder until the palms of her hands were flat against the wall, either side of his head, and the binder all but buried in the flesh of his neck. His face went purple, and he stopped struggling. Kiss let go and stood back. Sulden slid down the wall into a sitting position, his head flopping over onto one side. Sholto Unworth stood in the open doorway, just staring. He looked as if he wasn't taking much in, as if the world had become a place incomprehensible to him. Kiss walked across the cell and picked up the actuator wand Braid had dropped. She fiddled with the settings, then triggered it, and her binders automatically unlocked and fell off. She tossed the wand to Unworth, and he caught it.
"Get your shackles off. Quickly now."
Blinking, he did as he was told. She searched the bodies. Apart from some spare change and a pack of lows, they weren't carrying much of anything. She took one of the pistols, a sleek little snub las, and a spare power cell.
Unworth had freed himself.
What pertains now? He asked. We are getting out of here, Kiss said. I do not deserve, that is to speak. I have dishonored my service to you and your particulars. I never meant to invocal any materialisms, for I undertook my compactness with your master in most high seriousness. But they hurt me. They hurt me and...
Shut up, said Kiss. Face the wall, please. He did so. Kiss pulled the torn paper gown off over her head. Both Braid and Selden were far too big to trade clothes with, but Selden's suit jacket, buttoned up, was like a coat on her. She tucked the weapon and the power cell into one pocket and carried the wand in her left hand.
Come on, she said. Do exactly what I tell you, and don't speak.
Unworth nodded. Her own mouth still tingled oddly from the curious thing she had said. Patience had a nasty feeling she was beginning to understand what was going on in the administries of Eustace Majoris. If she was right, then the possibilities were terrifying. She peered out into the hall, a simple corridor, the locked hatches of other cells on either side. No one around. With Unworth in tow, she shut the cell behind her with the wand and started to walk. In the east, the last vestiges of the storm were grumbling in the low cloud, like slow-motion firecrackers. A light rain persisted in the air, enough to keep the alarm posts flashing. The late evening was dark and murky. Nail came up the steps of the transit station and onto an empty street walk. Not even Gamper's out at this hour. He sheltered under a glass rain cover and coded his hand vox by the light of the nearby street lamp. Up ahead, the towering peak of Administry Tower 3 was visible against the night sky, only because of its millions of window lights.
It's Nail. Anything yet?
No, Harlan. Still nothing.
I'm in the tower approaches now. I can wait here all night if necessary.
Understood. I'll let you know as soon as we get anything. Nail put his vox away and stared up at the lights.
Come on, Patience,
he murmured.
Come on, girl. Give us a sign.
Though she hated to admit it, Kara suspected Belknap knew what he was talking about. There was something infinitely reassuring and calming about the candlelit majesty of a great ecclesiarchy building. Night song was due to commence in a few minutes, and a small congregation was gathering. Knowing that the temple elders would look unfavorably on a hand vox chiming in the middle of mass, Kara went back out into the towering vestibule and made a call.
Kara, have you heard anything from Patience yet?
We haven't, I'm afraid, I told her.
Look, just so you know, my hand vox will be switched off for the next half an hour or so.
Why?
I'm attending night song, she said. I don't want to disturb the ceremony.
A pause. I don't remember you ever attending night song, Kara. She felt awkward suddenly.
I just felt like it, Gideon. Belknap suggested that a little religious observance might be good for my soul and help with the healing process. He's quite old-fashioned, I think. Anyway, the idea appealed to me. I'm such a heathen most of the time. Besides, all of us could do with a prayer or a blessing right now, couldn't we?
I suppose so. Kara, is there something you're not telling me?
No, she laughed. Don't be silly.
There's something in your voice.
Honestly, Gideon.
She glanced at the guide pamphlet she'd taken from a nearby table.
I'm just deciding. Deciding whether to take night song here in the Grand Templum or next door in the sacristy.
What did you say just then? I asked. Carl and Zeph looked over at me.
I said I'm just deciding whether to...
No, at the end there. Did you say sacristy? Zale got up from the sofa and walked right over to my side.
Yes, the old sacristy. It adjoins the Grand Templum, according to this guide, but it's much older. I quite like the sound of it.
I told you, Zale said.
I told you. I had a dream.
Kara, I said on the link, can you tell me why you're there?
Because Belknap.
No, Kara. That place especially. You say you're at the Grand Templum. That's in Formal A, isn't it?
Yes. What's the matter?
Why there? There was a hesitation on the line.
Belknap suggested I should go to Temple for the good of my soul. So I thought, if I'm going to do that, I might as well go to the biggest. That's here, the Grand Templum. Gideon, have I done something wrong?
No, I replied. But you may have done something very right. Kara, as you're there, could you do something for me?
Anything.
Could you go to this old sacristy for me and take a look around? Just take a look.
All right. Can I ask why?
I was aware of Zale's bright eyes staring down at me. It's probably nothing. Just an odd coincidence. But there's also a chance, just a chance, that we're experiencing some confluence of fate. Something preordained. Something Zale saw in a dream.
I see. Well, all right.
Just check it out for me. If the God Emperor or his agencies of fortune are smiling our way, I'd like to take advantage of it. Like you said, we could all use a blessing right now.
I'll take a look and call back shortly,
she said, and closed the link.
What was that about?
Carl asked me. I'll tell you if it turns into anything, I said. Still nothing from patience. Carl shook his head.
Something else, though,
he said.
I've had my cogitator support engines processing the material Kiss sent us all evening, trying to translate it or make some sense of it.
And?
Still no sense. It's absolutely meaningless. Random. Except.
What?
Asked Zeph. It's burned out the support engines. Completely erased the index drive. They'd both just died on me 5 minutes ago.
Four men in dark suits went by, their feet clattering on the stone floor. Once they were out of sight, Kiss and Unworth came out of cover and moved on. She wasn't sure if it was just terror or a fierce determination to do as she'd told him, but Unworth was managing to be very stealthy. He slipped from shadow to shadow, watching for her every gesture. She felt sorry for him. She'd loathed him during the voyage, but now realized he was touchingly loyal. He had suffered so much because of them. I'm going to get you out, she decided. I'm going to get you to safety, Master Unworth. It's the very least I can do. They crept along the dark passageways of the secretist enclave. They sidled past open doorways that looked into rooms where hard-faced personnel worked at data engine consoles, rooms where men in protective clothing bent over sheets of paper laid out on underlit glass tables, rooms that looked like library annexes, rooms where pneumatic tubes delivered message cylinders into racks for the operators to open and sort. Kiss could hear a distant humming, a vibration that quivered the floor, as if heavy machinery was working nearby. She pointed the actuator wand at a wall panel and lit up a hololithic building plan in the air. Hangar. That was what she wanted. Two floors up, a stairwell just along to... Someone was coming. She wandered open a door and pulled Unworth into the shadows of the arch. Two secretists went past, cannon hounds straining at their leashes. They stopped a few meters beyond the doorway, starting a conversation with someone they'd met, coming the other way. Kiss heard one of the secretists snap at his servitor to heel. No going that way. She took Unworth by the hand, shuddering a little as her grip encountered his missing fingers. She led him along the dark passage behind the door she'd wanded open. The humming grew louder. The tunnel broke at a T-junction. They went right, and she wanded open another hatch. The chamber beyond was enormous. They were overlooking it from a gantry walk. This was the source of the noise. Below them, a large number of gigantic machines rattled and spun, circling streams of light and coherent energy around their spindles and rushing gears. Tiny figures moved around the machines beneath them, adjusting and fine-tuning the rate of flow. Processing flow. Kiss did a quick calculation and counted 60 machines. Data looms. The secretists had 60 data looms, working in unison.
Holy throne, Kiss breathed.
Even the Administratum Center on Thracian Primaris only had 4 looms to process the planetary data flow. Carl had once told her that Scarus itself boasted 30 looms, through which the accumulated business of the sector was handled. The stuff he knew.
60 looms. Not this way, then,
she smiled at Unworth. They turned back and headed up the tunnel again. The tech adept coming around the corner nearly slammed into them. Who? He began to say. She coshed him with the wand, and then shot him through the temple with her snub-las once he was on the ground. The background roar of the looms covered the brief report. They hurried on up the tunnel to another hatch. She checked the nearest wall panel again, studying the hololith.
Stairwell, she said. This is good. We can reach the hangar from here.
That is most profuse,
Unworth nodded. Kiss waved the actuator wand at the hatch. Nothing happened. She did it again, and again. Then she tapped the wand and examined it. The casing was fractured. Some of the studs no longer worked. Clubbing the adept with it had been a bad idea.
"Oh, for throne's sake," she hissed. "Give me a break."
She looked round. Unworth had disappeared.
"Sholto,"
she growled, taking out her weapon.
"Sholto! Throne, help me. Where the hell have you?"
He hurried back into view out of the tunnel's shadows. He was clutching a small, battered toolkit that he'd recovered from the dead adept.
"In all pertinacity,"
he began.
"Don't even start. Can you open this door?"
Kiss snapped. Unworth knelt down, opened the toolkit, and produced a power driver.
"Let's see,"
he said.
"Cross your fingers. I would, but malfortunately I don't have enough."
"My fingers are crossed, Sholto. Do it."
Chapter 8 Bonehart and Mole were waiting for Revoke in the bustling main hall as he stepped out of the elevator.
"Is he here?" Revoke asked.
"Arrived 10 minutes ago," Bonehart said. "We put him in private audience 3. Monica's watching him."
"He sent a list of instructions," Mole said. "Requirements is what he called them. I have to say he's got some front, but we're working to meet them."
Revoke nodded.
"Do you trust him?" Bonehart asked.
"His abilities?" Revoke said.
"Yes. I've done some background. His credentials are impeccable. He's the best there is. Do I trust him as a person?"
"No, not at all.
But we're going with it anyway."
The three of them started to walk.
"There's another thing," Bonehart said. "We picked up a girl from Administry Tower 3 today. Seemed like a regular sublim event at first, but we're pretty sure she's one of Ravenna's people."
"I know," said Revoke. "Salden called me direct."
"The Telekine, right?" Bonehart nodded.
"Thing is, Taurus, if there was any doubt she was one of Ravenna's own, it's gone now. Routine cell check found Salden and Braid dead. She's loose."
Revoke stopped.
"Loose in here?"
"Yes, sir."
"Damn it. I've got to do this thing now, and with any luck it'll make using the Telekine redundant. Ravenna should be dead by morning.
But find her, the both of you. Personally see to it she's caught and killed."
Bonehart and Mole nodded. Behind them, an elevator hatch opened, and the chief provost stepped out. All the junior servants in the hall stopped what they were doing and curtsied or bowed.
"Get lost," Revoke whispered to Bonehart and Mole. "I've got this to handle."
They nodded and hurried off. Trice advanced across the hall to join Revoke. Trice was wearing his most opulent robes of office, and 3 servo skulls circled around him. A senior cipherist in a hooded cape of red velvet followed him, bearing a small metal casket with reverence.
"Taurus," Trice smiled.
"He's waiting for us, sir," Revoke replied, bowing.
"Then I'm eager to get this over with. I've just been with the Diadochoi. He's in an especially foul mood. It seems he's heard rumors of a problem, and is annoyed that I'm withholding the details. I've tried to be circumspect. If he discovers Ravenna is active and hunting here on Eustace, he'll lose it completely. You know how he is about Ravenna,
sir."
"So, if I'm going to tell him anything, I'd like it to be that there was a problem, but now it's done. I'd like to tell him Ravenna is dead."
"Then let's make that happen," Revoke suggested. He opened the door to private audience 3 and ushered Trice and the cipherist inside.
Monica was standing just inside the room, a fizzle of empty air. She bowed. At the far end of the long table sat Orfeo Culzean. Layla Slade stood behind him, her arms folded as tightly as her expression. Revoke closed the door and sealed it.
"Chief Provost,"
Culzean said, rising to his feet and bowing gently.
"An honor."
"Master Culzean," Trice replied. "I have heard a lot about you."
"All bad, I hope,"
Culzean replied.
"Let me start by saying, just for the record, the attempt on your life that I orchestrated, well, that was nothing personal."
"Understood."
They shook hands.
"Sit, please," Trice said.
Revoke pulled out a chair to accommodate the chief provost.
"You have a problem,"
Culzean began, leaning forward and clasping his hands together.
"An individual. Let's call him Subject R."
"Let's call him that bastard Ravenna,"
Trice smiled. Culzean nodded and grinned back.
"So noted. An individual that you want to track, locate, and destroy. I have the means to achieve this. The skills, the weapons. I've already forwarded my requirements to your people. I trust they're all to your satisfaction."
Trice sat back.
"How will you find him?" We've searched, but so far we've failed.
With respect, sir,
Kalzian said.
You've used psychers, as I understand it. Ravana is too skillful to fall for that. My intel shows he uses untouchables, a resource he inherited from his mentor, Eisenhorn. With an untouchable active nearby, Ravana would be just a blank to the very best of your mind slaves. He's cunning, sir. He blocks his mind from prying eyes.
So how do you intend to locate him, Master Kalzian?
I will be using the thief, Chief Provost, an incunabula. I believe you are aware of its work.
Too well, Trice said, with a tiny smile.
Shielded or not, untouchable or not untouchable, the thief will locate him. It's what it does. The thief will certainly find Ravana, and therein lies the quandary.
How so? Trice asked.
Under regular circumstances, the thief is summoned and controlled. This means it must be fed, and then instructed. The control apparatus requires a talented psyker to direct the thief. However, that control will be lost if the thief enters the range of Ravana's untouchable. In other words, we can unleash the thief, send him after Ravana, and then lose possession of him the moment he comes close to the target.
So how do you propose we do this? Asked Trice. Kalzian shrugged.
Here's where the give and take comes in, sir. With your help, I can instruct the thief in a different way. No need for feeding, no need for psychic manipulation. We command it using enuncia.
Trice paused. Revoke told me you were remarkably well informed about our work here.
I like to be well informed,
Kalzian said.
It was a chance deduction, actually. I observed Master Revoke's efforts against the brass thief, and enuncia was the only thing he could conceivably have been using.
That's quite a deduction, Revoke said. Enuncia is extremely obscure. Its appearance in Imperial records fragmentary. Even the most learned people have never even heard of it. Kalzian maintained his calm, cordial manner.
I am a specialist operator in the workings of the arcane, Master Revoke. I am not most people. There are, of course, many things I don't have an answer to. For example, as you said, there are probably no more than 24 references to enuncia in all of the Imperial archives, and all of those in extremely restricted works. Only a couple of those references actually contain any operable semantics or accidents. I presume, therefore, you have uncovered a significant new lexical source for you to be so fluent.
In a way, Trice said, but more by reconstruction than recovery. If our relationship bears fruit, Master Kalzian, we will unfold the truth for you.
That's all I ask, said Kalzian. Bring me in on enuncia, and I'll deliver anything you want. Call it payment for dealing with Ravana.
Done, said Trice, simply. And as a gesture of good faith, he nodded to the waiting cipherist. The cipherist opened the metal box and showed Kalzian what lay within. The commands required for the incunabula, Trice said, written in enuncia and inscribed on an inert metal wafer. Don't try to read it. Revoke will do that for you. He's trained.
Well, this is wonderful,
Kalzian said.
Let's get started.
Taurus, Trice said as he got to his feet, have the psychers woken and brought to readiness.
There's no need, sir,
Kalzian said. Maybe not, but I'd like them ready anyway. Trice straightened his gown. If the thief leads us to Ravana and Ravana drops his guard, I want my psychers right there to finish the job. The choir was singing the night song counterpart. The sound rose into the upper rafters of the grand templum, pure and clear. Kara walked out of the west entrance and along a cloister towards the old sacristy. In the blackness, the distant sound of the choir seemed like a mournful wind. Kara had her hand on the butt of her weapon. There was nothing out here except darkness and dripping rain. The path was blocked with sawhorses, and the sign read, Old Sacristy, closed for renovations. She turned back, reaching for her handvox. Behind her, 2 quick cracks of lasfire, running feet in the dark. She drew her weapon and ducked into cover. Another 2 snipshots, blinking in the darkness. More pounding feet, clattering over gravel. A figure appeared, walking right past her. A young man, skinny, with augmetic eyes. He was walking strangely, plodding, trudging almost. As he went by Kara's hiding place, something fell out of his hand and bounced on the path. A compact 8mm. The young man fell over and lay still. She crept over to him, rolled him over. His body was going cold. 2 huge laser wounds had cut through his torso.
Oh, Throne,
Kara said as her hand came up wet with blood. There was someone behind her. She turned and saw the muzzle of a Transvasa 9 aiming right at her head.
"You bitch," said a voice. "You killed him. You bloody killed Limwall. You bitch."
"Now wait,"
Kara began. Gunfire drowned her words. Wind gusted over the rooftop landing pad. Kalzean had insisted that the ritual had to be performed in the open. A ring of taper flares had been lit, blue luminosity wafting up into the high-level air as smoke. The wrought pyramid of the incunabula sat in the center of the ring.
"Master Revoke," Kalzean said. "Begin, please."
Revoke took the inert metal wafer from the cipherist's open coffer and stepped forward. He read the words aloud. His lips split, and blood leaked down the sides of his mouth. The brass thief exploded into being and surged up into the night sky. The hatch, once Unworth had fiddled with it, opened. The hangar lay before them. One end opened to the sky, and a row of armored flyers sat in heavy deck clamps in front of the bay's mouth. They started to run across the empty deckway towards the nearest flyer. A lasbolt smacked into the deck close to Unworth, who jumped back with a squeal. Kiss threw herself into him and rolled them into the cover of a repair cart. More shots zipped over them. From a hatch in the far corner of the hangar, a half-dozen secretists were running forward, firing. Kiss pulled her snub las and returned shots over the cart, forcing the secretists to scatter into cover themselves.
"Get in! Get it fired up!"
she yelled at Unworth. He crawled on his belly into the shadow of the deck clamp and reached up to fuss with the flyer's door latches. More shots rained at them. One blew the lid off the repair cart's panniers, another chipped bodywork of the flyer. Kiss leaned out and raked fire back at them. She clipped one of the secretists as he attempted to rush into better cover.
"Unworth!"
The doors popped. Unworth wriggled up into the tight cockpit. Kiss fired off another salvo of shots and leapt in after him.
"Now!"
Kiss yelled. Shots were spanking off the rear of the machine. The window panel of one of the open doors shattered.
"You requisite me to fly this?"
Unworth asked.
"Yes, I sodding requisite so. Get us out of here."
Unworth thumped main power with his maimed hand. He grabbed the stick as the flyer shot itself off the deck clamp. Safety systems auto-closed the doors. The flyer, nose down, barreled out under the arch of the hangar mouth and into the night sky. Either deliberately or accidentally, Kiss couldn't tell, Unworth pitched them into a steep dive. The vast lit side of the governor's palace rushed past behind them like an illuminated cliff. Below, the canyons of the hive's upper stacks yawned. Unworth turned them down into an upper alt-traffic flow. Flyers and lifters zipped about them. The collision alarm made at least three warning bleats.
"Where?"
he asked, desperately.
"Where what? Where would you produce us to go?"
Kiss began. Back in the hangar, Mole turned to Bonehard, who had just entered at a run.
"They've affected exit," Mole said. "Flyer 87, we've got it tagged."
Folon, holding his cyberlure, was right behind Bonehard.
"Sing them in,"
Bonehard ordered. Folon began to spin the lure. Outside, swirling dark clouds billowed from the roofscapes and gargoyle-encrusted rain gutters of the stack tops. The clouds coiled through the air like smoke wound into a vortex by an updraft and fused into one. The unkindness of sheenbirds, turning together in a dense, unified swarm, swept down towards the speeding flyer.
"Unworth, watch it!" Kiss yelled. "What the hell is—"
The first two or three smacked against the flyer's canopy, cracking the glass.
"Bother,"
said Unworth, wrestling with the stick. Then the rest came in, like a wave, like a chrome blizzard. Kiss saw them coming, their wings glinting in the darkness.
"Oh, shit," she said.
Kara dragged the girl into cover as the shots ripped past.
"Stay down,"
she said, and fired off a clip into the darkness of the cloister. Silence briefly, then confused shouts.
"Move!"
Kara cried. The girl came with her. They sprinted down the outside walk of the Grand Templum. Behind them, they could hear feet crunching on gravel. Another shot or two sang out.
"Thrawn, do you have an exit plan?"
Kara yelled.
"My transporter! It's just down here!"
They ran down an unlit side street to the parked Bergman. The running footsteps were closing behind them. Kara jumped in the moment the doors unlocked. The girl put it into drive, and they roared down the street and out across the square.
She had to haul on the wheel to avoid a big grey transporter that was just pulling out of the Templin's front approach. "That way!" Kara shouted, pointing. The girl heaved the speeding vehicle round, its back end sliding out slightly on the wet stone, and hammered them away down a link ramp towards the interformal arterial. Several transporters braked and sounded their horns as the Bergman dashed by, ignoring all the circulation control lights.
"You drive like a marshal," Kara said.
"I am a marshal.
I'm Kara Swall.
You?"
"Maud Plighton."
A laser bolt punched through the roof and out through the front screen. Plighton yelped and swerved. The big grey transporter, with a man leaning out of the side window, training a Hellgun, rushed down the high stack ramp after the speeding Bergman. The Hellgun began to fire again. Chapter 9.
"Signal from Kara," Carl said suddenly. "She's in some kind of trouble."
"Let me speak to her," I said. Carl didn't get a chance to obey my instruction. The Vox systems let out a painfully loud wail of distortion and died. Simultaneously, Carl's cogitators flickered and shut down. The house lights dimmed.
"Oh, really not good," Carl began.
"The stuff you know,"
Mathewin growled. He was already running from the room.
"We're under attack," Zale said.
"It could be almost anything," I started to say. Zale looked at me with a cold, calm certainty.
"No, I'm telling you, we're under attack."
Outside the room, downstairs, a terrible rending impact sounded from the main door. The security systems warbled fitfully for a second and died. More crashing, tearing noises resounded. I sped out of the room. "Carl, keep Zale here with you. Do everything you can to keep him safe." Carl had already drawn his handgun and pulled Zale over into the corner of the room, away from the doorway. Frauke hurried out after me and slammed the door. I went out onto the landing and began to glide down the stairs. From halfway down, I could see the main body of the entrance hall and what was left of the front doors. And I could see what was approaching across the hall. It was the thing I'd sensed the fiber traces of at the diplomatic palace. The primeval throwback. The Incunabula. A figure of gold and smoking brass, its helm high-crested and devoid of any mark except narrow eye-slits. It had broken in through the heavy wooden metal of the doorway, littering the floor with debris, and now padded forward, shoulders hunched, the crested helm switching to and fro. Gusting eddies of warp vapor clung to its limbs like streamers. It looked up and saw me on the stairs. It raised its hands and, with an odd, wet click, extended paired rhyming swords. Behind me, I heard Frauke gasp. "Bollocks to this." "Get back, Whiston," I said. With his limiter still off, I had no defense capabilities whatsoever. The Incunabula flew at me, its swords coming together to form a two-pronged spear held out in front of it. A shockwave of immense firepower blew it backwards out of the air and clean across the hall, through a wall, into the lower lounge. Zeth Mathewin strode forward across the hall below me, his rotator cannon slung in place, the multi-barrel still spinning as he came. He fired another blurt, destroying more of the wall, the rotating muzzles kicking out star-shaped flashes of ignited gas.
"Get out of here," Mathewin yelled, without looking up at us. "Get out while you still can."
A scratching, slithering sound came from inside the lower lounge, and the Incunabula reappeared. There were sooty marks on its chest plating, but no sign it had been damaged at all. Mathewin opened fire again and threw it backwards once more, walking forward to press his attack, mercilessly blasting streams of high-velocity shells at the golden killer. It reeled, bucked, jerked, unable to ignore the kinetic impact, but was still undamaged. Gradually it began to crunch towards Mathewin, one foot after the other, weathering the blizzard of shots like a man trudging head down into torrential rain. The rotator gears of Zeph's cannon were whirring shrilly. It was close to overheating, running out of ammunition, or both. 3 meters from Mathewin, 2, shrugging off the hail of shells, one struggling step at a time. "Whiston," I yelled, "activate, activate." The brass thief sliced around with its right-hand blade and cut Zeph's rotator cannon in half. In the explosion that resulted, shards of shrapnel burst out of the ruined mechanism. Mathewin was thrown almost the full length of the hall. The Incunabula ignored him and swung back to face me. I was what it was after. Just me. But now Whiston had activated his limiter. My mind surged free, unrestrained. With a pop, the psi cannon deployed from the chair's casing, and I began to fire.
My first two shots actually managed to dent its chest plating. My third slightly buckled its left cheek and left a scratch on the brass. Still, it came on. In the chilly basement vaults of the governor's palace, the five psykers began to mumble and thrash in their lead tanks. Revoke pushed two of the handlers aside and took a look at the biometric display. Nearby, Kalzean smiled and simply clapped his hands together. He already knew what was happening.
"We forced his hand," Kalzean said. "Ravener can't deal with the thief without his mind powers. He's told his untouchable to limit. He should be very visible to you now."
"Is he?" Trice asked. Revoke nodded. "Ultra-solid return. A house in formal E, 9th Ward. I'm dispatching elements right now." "Never mind that," Trice said. "Send the psykers in."
For a moment, for a fleeting second, I thought I had the measure of this monstrous incunabula. I was pinning it with my mind as I fired cannon shot after cannon shot into it, actually splintering slivers of gold off its armor. It fought back to break my grip on it with furious power, but my will was no trifling thing. I actually had it fast, tight, in a vice of psi energy. Then the psykers swirled in. Bodiless, they burst into Miseramus all around me, streaking comets of vile, white light that swirled and circled and laughed with gleeful inhuman voices. Every lamp, window, glow-globe and drinking glass in the house shattered. Floorboards ripped up like twigs. Doors burst off their hinges. Flying nails and screws and tacks peppered through the air like hail. The banisters behind me collapsed, and I heard Frauke cry out as he was thrown off the stairs into the hall below. "Wisden!" He was unconscious, or dead. Either way, he couldn't deactivate his limiter and block these unholy wraiths out. Two fell upon me at once, amorphous crackling skeins of corpuscent, coating the surface of my chair in heavy crusts of ice. They shook at me, ripping at my mind. A mind that was already more than occupied, holding the incunabula at bay. The pain was immense. Invisible talons, cold as the intercosmic chill, tore through the outer defenses of my soul. Peals of mirthless laughter echoed in from distant, insane worlds of warp horror and abomination. I tried to drive them back, prize their clammy grip off my shuddering mind. But it took strength. It took effort. My hold on the brass thief was slipping away. Its rhyming swords raised to strike. It took its first step towards me. In the upstairs chamber, Zale yelled in fear as Miseramus shook again and again.
"Shut up!"
Carl bellowed, glancing around as objects vibrated and moved, or flew clean across the room. His work chair was turning in circles all by itself. His cogitator vomited sparks as the main screen shattered. Bulging shapes slid up and down under the wallpaper. Holding Zale close to him, Carl stood in the center of the darkened room, turning in frantic circles as the air churned and eddied around him. A flying data slate hit him on the cheek. He ducked as a storage case spun across the room.
"Begone! Begone!" Carl yelled.
His handgun, useless anyway, had already been yanked out of his hand by the maelstrom. He tried to form a hexagrammatic ward to fight the onslaught. Invisible forces, laughing at the edge of hearing, grabbed Carl and slammed him hard against the wall, pinning him spread-eagled 2 meters up. Zale screamed out. The boy had fallen to his hands and knees and gazed up at Carl's helpless body. Terrible pressures were crushing Carl into the wall.
"Holy God, Emperor!"
Carl shrieked in agony. Zale buried his head in his hands and cowered on the floor. There was an odd cracking sound that he was certain had to be bones breaking. A scatter of metal objects rained down on the carpet in front of him. Zale blinked. They were Carl's rings, the 30 or so rings that had adorned the fingers and thumb of Carl's right hand. Every single one of them was twisted and snapped open, burst as if split from within.
"Carl?"
Zale stammered. He looked up. I was almost insensible with pain. The cold hands of the psykers were upon me, guzzling at my strength, dragging me down to hell. My hold on the incunabula finally gave way. Its first strike raked across the front of my chair. The second blow, with the other blade, scored the metal deeper. The third punched through, severing vital systems and shooting more pain into my besieged brainstem. Something knocked the brass thief back away from me. I tried to focus through the swirling mayhem of light and wind and debris. I saw Zeph,
He was wounded in the left side from the detonating cannon. His clothes were tattered and bloody, and his augmetic left arm hung in sparking ruins. In his right hand, he clutched Kara's shivered sword. He struck the brass thief again, drawing a prickle of sparks from its armor, and then blocked the rhyming swords as they cut at him. Stab and parry, one frantic sword against two. He'd given me a moment's grace. I focused my will on the most immediate psyker and drove it off me with a barbed psi-lunge. The rotting ghost squealed and retreated a little, but at least two more were there, bleating and greasy. I could feel some huge psychic force gathering above me, focused on the floor above. Karl's room. Something born of the darkest warp was boiling into fury up there. I heard screams. Inhuman screams. In the basement vault, Trice and Kalzean looked around at the lead holding tanks. All five were vibrating, like pots on a stove. Warning lights were flashing on all across the biometric consoles. At least three of the handlers had collapsed, blood pouring from their tear ducts and nostrils.
"What the hell is happening?"
Trice yelled over the uproar. There was a loud bang, and one of the tanks cracked. Suspension fluid squirted out. The fluid was boiling.
"We've lost a psyker,"
Revoke yelled, trying to harness the remaining units.
"Lost? He's dead. Burnt out."
The lid blew off another tank, gushing scalding fluid over the lip. The fleshly body of the psyker inside had just exploded.
"Is this Ravenna?"
Trice yelled.
"No,"
said Kalzean, his face quite pale.
"Listen."
The three remaining psykers were screaming. Screaming out one word, over and over, a name.
Slight, 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 slight.
Power seemed to leave the psykers assaulting me for a moment. I threw them away from me, summoning my strength to re-engage the brass thief. Zeph Mathewin ducked under one sweeping blow, then sliced the shivered sword upwards with a deft undercut. It drove entirely through the incunabula's torso. Miasmal energy, like ichor, dribbled and ran from around the impaling blade. Zeph tried to pull the sword out, but it was wedged fast. The brass thief lunged. Mathewin blinked. The incunabula slowly slid its rhyming swords out of Mathewin's chest. Zeph looked around at me, hopeless and lost, and fell dead on his face. Part 3. City of Men, City of Gods. Chapter 1. Later, I came to understand that was the moment that fury seized me. Fury, grief, outrage, and an all-consuming hatred I had never tasted before. I speared my telekinesis out along the devastated hallway and grasped the one parting gift Zeph Mathewin had left me. The shivered sword stuck through the incunabula's torso. I wasn't thinking anymore. I was all but insensible with rage. My will was stronger and more ferocious than I had ever known it. It was as if I was drawing vast supplements of strength from the psychic powers loose in the house around me, or as if some vengeful force of balefire from the most alien recesses of the warp was invigorating my mind. I wrenched the transfixed sword upwards and split the incunabula's chest armor through its brass sternum. The golden cage of its ribs broke open, releasing a gout of fetid, violet light from the demon's inchoate core. The brass thief twisted and writhed on the impaling sword, merely opening the chest wound wider. It made a mewling, whining sound. I fired my chair's psi cannon, not just once, perhaps a dozen times, two dozen even. Every scalding bolt I aimed into the incunabula's ruptured chest cavity, and I kept firing until the relentless salvos had the desired effect. The brass and gold mechanism of the incunabula's form ripped apart in a blossom of fire, whizzing fragments in every direction. The blast was of such force that the shivered sword came spinning away to thump, tip down and quivering, into the floorboards beside my chair. The empty helm was driven upwards by the fireball and embedded itself in the ceiling by its crest. The feral essence of the incunabula, the azoic demon spark, came shrieking out of the blast, free from the ancient device that had bound it for so long. It vanished, never, I imagine, to be found or enslaved again. The broken brass remains clattered to the floor like so much scrap metal, smoldering. I sank back, exhausted, my powers ebbing. There was a noise behind me, and I turned my chair quickly. Whiston Frauke, bleeding from the side of the head and covered with plaster dust, was pulling himself out of the wreckage beside the staircase.
"Hello?"
he was mumbling. "Ravenna. Anyone?" "Whiston," I transponded at full volume. "Your limiter. Now!" Foul psychic manifestations were still churning about the upper floors of the house, making torn, keening noises, and we were dreadfully exposed. Frauke fumbled with the small device at his throat and switched it off. A decompressive boom shook the walls as his untouchable effect closed the area down. The bodiless forms of the invading psychers were banished, negated by the sudden deadness. I heard roof tiles dislodge and shatter as the forces were ejected from the building. Within seconds, a torrential rainstorm began to drench the 9th ward of Formal E. Frauke gazed across the demolished ruin of the hallway, the shattered walls, the torn floorboards, the shot-up plaster. He saw the body lying near the entranceway.
"Mathewin?"
he began, then went quiet, realizing how pointless his question was. I powered back up the staircase, or what was left of it. I prayed to the golden throne of earth that I would find Thonius and Zale alive. I was puzzled and disturbed, too. The psychers had come for me initially, and then at least half of them had concentrated their attacks on Karl's room on the first floor, whereupon that loathsome psychic force had begun to gather up there. Why? The door was closed. Smoke, or vapor of some sort, drifted up from under the door, and a thick coating of rime iced the door and the walls either side, steaming as it began to thaw and slide to the floor. The door handle rattled, stopped, and then rattled again more urgently. Something was in there, trying to get out. Kiss howled as Unworth banked the flyer hard to evade the swirling flock, but the birds turned as one, like a glittering shoal of pelagic fish, and spurted after them. Unworth pulled the nose around again, racing them along an upstacked canyon, missing oncoming air traffic by the most horrifying of close margins. Heavier lifters, entering the canyon flow from above on guided descent, were forced to abort violently and rose away from the stacks, sirens sounding. Unworth yawed frantically from side to side, just avoiding a flyer that came head-on, lights blazing, and banked them around the tail end of a massive cargo lifter by executing a virtual stall turn. The armored flyer's jet pods wailed to gather lift as Unworth drove it on down a crossway. The unkindness billowed in a sparkling ball as it changed direction to follow them. Swiftly, the sheenbirds were gaining again, forming a mercurial ribbon of silver in the air that flowed in and out of the high-alt traffic faster than Unworth could weave the flyer between, under and over the slower-moving vehicles in the skyway.
"What in altercation are they?"
he yelled, fighting with the stick.
"Birds!"
Kiss shouted back.
"But machines!"
"Yes!"
"Yet they fly like birds!"
"Yes!" she screamed.
"Why? What does that matter?"
The front part of the beating swarm closed around them. They heard thousands of impacts as beaks and wings struck at the fuselage. Alarms sounded. Some of the sheenbirds had gone into one or more of the engine intakes, mangled by the jet screws.
"Hold on!"
Unworth cried out. He slammed the nose down and hit the boosters. The flyer broke away from the unkindness swarm and dropped like a missile into the depths of the stackway, burners lighting blue hot. The fluttering stream of metal forms spiraled and dived after it. They were dropping into the lower depths of the towering street, far too fast. Cross bridges and pedestrian overwalks shot by, Unworth going over some and under others. Kiss could see the multi-lanes of surface traffic coming up to meet them, saw the headlights, the illuminated indicator boards, the jagged neon pointers detailing sink ramps and off-arterial sublanes.
"Unworth," she began.
Still at full boost, the shipmaster grimly kept the nose down.
"Unworth!"
The flyer leveled and rocketed along 500 meters of surface street, passing at roof level over the traffic queue so violently that the concussion of its jet wash rocked transporters on their axles and blew out screens and door windows. Outraged citizens spilled out of their vehicles, only to duck back immediately, screaming in terror as the sheen storm rushed past a second later. Unworth sliced the flyer between the roof of a cargo 10 and a massive overrode indicator board. Kiss covered her eyes. Unworth pitched to the left suddenly, leaving the main surface arterial, and powered down over the traffic of a descender ramp. Within moments, they were chasing into the deep chasms of the undersink, into the interstack gulfs below the nominal surface level. Flyer traffic in the undersink was seriously restricted. It was darker and tighter, and there were many, many more bridges and crosswalks. Roadside klaxons and hazard lamps began to hoot and flash. Indicator screens lit up red with notices to abort flight path or slow down. Unworth did neither. He dropped lower, avoiding bridge spans that loomed suddenly out of the blackness, lower still, as if intent on plunging them into the very bottommost sumps and pits of the hive sinks. Still, the unkindness beat down after them.
"Birds, you said?"
Unworth repeated, concentrating as hard as he could, given the limited view ahead, his hands twisting and yanking the stick, the flyer rocking and banking violently.
"Yes,"
Kiss said, holding on tightly. She looked across at him.
"Why do you keep—"
She yelped as the flyer hit something with huge, glancing force. Unworth had misjudged an overhead duct, and the collision had torn part of the upper control surface from the flyer's tail. He fought to retain command, feeling the machine buck and try to spin out. Debris and crackling plumes of electrical discharge flurried back in the wounded craft's slipstream. They were losing speed. The front of the flock was beginning to bang and clatter against the hull again. A last turn, down yet another dim sublevel, right into the bilges now. Trailing a swirling, mobbing cloud of sheenbirds, they gunned down a deep trench of rusted girderwork, moss-black rockcrete and dripping acid, their rushing lamp beams picking up the accumulated filth and trash that trickled down through the undersink. There was no more down they could go. And now, Kiss realized, no more on, either. She saw the end of the trench ahead of them, a chain-link barrier, decaying hazard notices that were coming up too fast to read. The sump trench was a dead end. Over the din of the sheenbirds hammering and chipping at the hull, she cried out Unworth's name at the top of her voice. If he heard her, he didn't react in time. The armored flyer hit the barrier fence, taking most of the chain link along with it like a veil. It inverted, engines flaring, as it went over the sump wall, and hit the dark black water beyond in a huge cone of spray. "They're closing still," Kara warned. Plighton downshifted. "This is a Bergman Amity Velux," she said. "No one closes on a Bergman Amity Velux." The big black transporter surged forward down the steep, high stack ramp, its engine making the most spectacular roar. Behind it, the gray transporter dropped back a little, then began to push forward again. At this hour, the arterials of Formal A were fairly quiet. Long stretches of rockcrete highway tunnel flicked by, lit by sodium lamps. The man with the hell gun was still snapping off shots.
"That said, find an exit," Kara said.
"Hell with that," said Plighton.
"Do it! Another straight section, and they'll shoot out our wheels. Speed or no speed!"
As if to prove her point, a laser bolt hit the boot lid. The Bergman wavered. Lamps bright, the big gray transporter loomed behind them, jockeying to pull alongside, engine revving. Kara threw herself over the passenger seat into the back, reached out through the shattered rear screen, and fired her handgun. Her first shots missed. In reply, two more energy rounds tore sideways through the roof.
"Yeah, screw you,"
Kara said, and took aim again. She pumped six shots through the wide front screen of the big gray transporter. It faltered slightly, then abruptly went into a savage, uncontrolled spin.
"Plighton!"
Plighton hit the throttle and boosted the Bergman forward, just fast enough to avoid it being clipped from behind by the big, skidding transporter. The gray machine went across two lanes backwards and hit the central strip defenders, a barrier of sand drums and metal bars, with such force that it tore itself apart in a shower of glass and flying metal.
"Now get us off this damned arterial,"
Kara said. Plighton tore down the next exit into a gloomy substreet. She dropped her speed and made several random turns through quiet underlinks and cross streets. Finally, they pulled into a loading dock and parked in the cover of some rockcrete columns. Plighton killed the engine and the lights. They sat for a moment in the soft darkness, breathing hard. In the distance, they could hear vehicles roaring past on the arterial and the sound of sirens. Not just emergency responders, security alarms, too. They got out. Plighton walked the length of the Bergman in dismay.
"Look at it. Look at it. Uncle Valley will kill me when—"
She shut up suddenly. To Kara's surprise, she started to weep.
"Hey," said Kara.
Plighton shook her off and walked away into the shadows beyond the columns. Kara let the girl be. She fished out her handvox and punched in a code.
"Come on," she said. "Why aren't you answering? Ravana! Ravana, where are you?"
The channel refused to pick up. Kara was just putting in Harlan's code when she realized Plighton was staring at her. "What did you just say?" the marshal asked.
"What?"
"That name. That name!"
"Ravenna?"
Frauke had come to join me. He'd drawn his own compact weapon, for all the good that would do on a night like this. The door handle continued to rattle.
"You want me to?"
He pointed to his limiter. "Only if we really have to. Wait." Outside, the rain sluiced down. I was sure it wouldn't be long now before more conventional agents of our enemy arrived. The rattling finally ceased. There was a click, and the door swung open. Panting, Carl stood in the doorway, leaning for support against the splintered jamb. His clothes were torn, and serious bruises covered the bare flesh of his throat and the side of his face. Blood trickled from his left nostril.
"Oh, Throne," he gasped. "It's you."
"Carl?"
"I thought they were going to kill us. Tear us apart."
"Are you all right?"
"I'll live. I probably won't ever sleep soundly again, but I'll live."
"Where's Zale?" He gestured into the room behind him, and I sped past. Carl's room was utterly destroyed. Everything in it had been torn apart, every machine smashed, every stick of furniture reduced to slivers of wood and tufts of fabric. It looked as if a hurricane had passed through. Then again, the rest of the house was hardly what the landlord would describe as in good order. Zale was sitting on the floor in the middle of the room. The carpet around him was singed. He was staring into space, his eyes glazed.
"Zale."
The boy didn't reply.
"What happened?"
Frauke asked.
"Psychers," said Carl, wiping his nose. "Two or three of them, I think. I don't know. The place just turned upside down. These invisible hands, they pinned me to the wall."
Carl fingered the dark bruises around his throat.
"Crushing me. And..."
"Carl, what?" Thonius pointed a shaking hand at Zale.
"Zale? The boy? He just..."
"What?"
"Well, I don't know what he did exactly, but he destroyed them. I heard the psychers shrieking in the air. Zale was laughing, like a little kid playing with toys. I think I must have passed out then, because when I came round, everything was quiet, and he was just sitting there, like that, just zoned out."
"All right," I said. "Our priority right now is to get out of here, fast. I'll deal with Zale as soon as we're secure."
"Look," said Carl, "there's one other thing. I know we're all jumpy about this, and things have been said about Zale, and I sure as hell don't want to make trouble where there is none. But I heard a name. I don't know if it was in my mind after I passed out, if I dreamt it or what, but I'd swear the psychers were howling out a name. They were saying, Slight.
I saw Frauke look at me. It was one of the few times I knew exactly what he was thinking, even though he was an untouchable. "We will deal with this later," I said. "I'll watch over the boy. Frauke, see what, if anything, you can salvage from the wreckage. 10 minutes, no longer. Carl, go and get the cargo 8 from the garages and bring it round the front."
"Can't Zeff do that?"
Carl said.
"Methuen's dead," Frauke told him.
It was getting so cold out on the tower approaches in Formal A that Harlan Nail was almost tempted to find one of the late-night oven barrows and buy a cup of the perniciously awful liquid they claimed was soup. He moved from foot to foot, rubbing his hands together, praying for a call from someone. Anyone. It had been almost an hour. Finally, when he could stand it no longer, he coded his vox and called the house. Nothing. "Channel dead," the display read. With mounting alarm, he tried Thonius's channel, then Methuen's, then even Frauke's. Each one flashed up as dead. He started to run back towards the rail transit. By the time he'd reached the stone steps into the station, he was sprinting. Chapter 2 A fragrant scent of sweet corruption, mixed with acrid fumes, drifted through the lower levels of the governor's palace, concentrated in the floors given over to the secretist's enclave. Someone had at last managed to cancel the blaring alarms, and crash teams had moved in, tending to the injured, putting out machine fires, and beginning repair and recovery work. The chief provost, shaking with what Revoke presumed to be barely contained rage, had withdrawn to the safety of an armored parlor in the cap levels of the tower, taking Kul'zean and Kul'zean's female bodyguard with him. Revoke wanted to stay to supervise the recovery, but he knew Trice probably needed protection at this ill-fortuned time, so he left Mole and Bonehart in charge and accompanied his master. The parlour was part of Trice's personal suite of apartments. Refined, luxurious, it was softly lit by recessed lumen strips and standard lamps, and lined with library shelves of books and slates built into the wood panelling. Kalzean had taken a seat. As ever, he looked remarkably unruffled, and happily accepted a drink one of the servitors offered him. His guard, Slade, lingered nearby, tense and edgy. Trice paced for a while.
"Ravenor,"
he said, coming to a halt. For the third time since the mayhem in the basement vaults, Kalzean shook his head and said,
"No, not Ravenor. Chief Provost, that was something more."
"Your demon?"
"Not mine,"
Kalzean said, sipping and sitting back.
"Yes, I was previously employed to facilitate the manifestation of Slight, but I work for you now."
Trice laughed mirthlessly.
"Get me a drink,"
he snapped at one of the attending servitors.
"How convenient, Master Kalzean," he said, "that the goal of your previous job was so admirably accomplished tonight. A suspicious man might be tempted to think this was all part of your scheme."
"Are you a suspicious man, Chief Provost?"
Kalzean asked. "Explain to me how I might otherwise read this disaster," Trice snapped. Kalzean put his glass down and leaned forward, gently smoothing his hands together. His voice was so well-pitched, so gently modulated.
"First of all, what happened tonight was a confluence, a combination of events. To clarify, the divine flattery, through catoptric means of prediction, prophesies that a potent force, known as Slight, would be brought into being here before the end of the year. Its manifestation would directly attach to the Inquisitor Ravenor, or one of his party of specialists. They employed me to make this possibility a certainty. Because you and your ministry and your grand work are entirely opposed to Ravenor, that made you key obstacles to the process, which, of course, is why we got off to a bad start."
Kalzean smiled. Trice did not.
"Anyway, with my help, you moved against Ravenor. This could have finished the flattery schemes. Kill Ravenor, and, of course, you doom the prophecy. Or, as seems to have happened, it provided the catalyst for the event. I did remark, as I remember, that the psychers weren't such a great idea."
Trice glared at him.
"Are you suggesting that I..."
"I'm suggesting," Kalzean put in smoothly, "that you stop worrying. If Slight's being born, then Slight's being born. The flattery will be delighted. In time, Slight may become a problem. But right now, he's just a warp thing, spat out into our material world. Do you have any idea how many cacodemons and sprites are conjured up by lunatic cults in the undersinks of a hive this big every year? By the time Slight grows to be any kind of threat, your project here in the city will have advanced to such a level that he will be a threat you can extinguish with the merest word. Or have I overestimated the scope of your designs?"
"You haven't," Trice said.
"Put a smile on your face," said Kalzean. "Press forward. Use me, because I can help you. And think of this. Slight has done one thing to help you. If he has manifested, Ravenor is dead. Obliterated. The demons done your wet work for you."
Trice nodded. "If what you're saying is true, Master Kalzean, I'll be delighted, despite the damage and losses we've incurred tonight. And I will use you, as you say. You boasted of many weapons in your arsenal as a facilitator. I want you to guard us against Slight. Revoke will give you any resources you need." Kalzean was about to reply when the main hatch to the parlor slid open. A shocked hush fell as a man walked in. Kalzean stared at the figure with contained surprise and rose to his feet. Tall, slender, dressed in long black robes, the newcomer was unmistakably the Lord Governor Subsector, Oscar Ludolf Barazan. Barazan walked directly over to Yeda Trice and slapped him around the face so hard it knocked Trice to the deck.
"You useless wretch,"
Barazan spat.
"Four psychers destroyed? Four of them! And the other one so badly mauled, she'll have to be put down? The alarms woke me. Did you think I wouldn't find out?"
"My lord," Trice cried out, seemingly less concerned that he had been knocked down than he was that Kalzean had witnessed it.
"We have visitors! Visitors! Not while you wear your public guise!"
Barazan kicked Trice in the ribs and made him double up in pain. Calmly, the Lord Governor Subsector turned and smiled at Kalzean. Calzean had seen that face so many times on newscasts and picked channels.
Master Calzean, we haven't met,
Marazan said, holding out his gloved hand. Calzean bowed and kissed the ring of office.
An honor, my lord.
Get up,
Marazan jeered at Trice. Revoke stepped forward and helped the chief provost onto a sofa. Marazan turned back to Calzean, his smile broad.
Yeda is worried that my little outburst might have unsettled you.
Calzean shrugged.
It's not every day, sir, that a man witnesses a lord subsector corporally punishing his chief provost. But no, I'm not unsettled.
Oh, and why is that?
Calzean thought about his next words very carefully. If he had read this wrong, Revoke would probably slay him in a second.
Because, sir, no scheme of this scale could have been set up without the full knowledge of the Lord Governor.
I like him,
Marazan said, glancing at Trice and Revoke.
He's very sharp, this one. Very perceptive.
Marazan turned around, regarding the Chief Provost.
I've been observing your conversation for days now, in fact. What is the point of having secretists if they keep secrets from you?
Marazan winked at one of the servitors. It shimmered and became Monica.
Thank you, my dear. As ever, you serve me well. Yeda, I know about Ravana, damn his name, and I know about your efforts to destroy him without me knowing about it. How thoughtful, Yeda, to spare my nerves the worry that bastard was active here on Eustace.
Lord, I...
Shut up, Yeda! Is Ravana dead?
He asked Calzean.
I think it's very likely, Lord.
And this slight... The demon offers no challenge to us.
It depends what you intend to do, sir,
Calzean replied.
I've not been told in any detail, naturally. The chief provost is too wise to leak that sort of data to an untrusted minion. But I can imagine. I have ideas. If I'm right... Slight, whatever its power, is just a bug to be crushed along the way.
Good.
So long as...
So long as what?
Marazan asked.
You do whatever you're going to do, quickly. Chaos has a habit of escalating. It's hard to read, harder to predict. Slight's nothing now, but soon. Well, I recommend you put your plan together and act right now.
Exactly what I was thinking,
said Marazan.
I told you I liked this man. Wise counsel.
My lord, Trice said, getting up, urgent. The project is not finished. Another month, perhaps 6 weeks, and we'll have completed the lexicon. I've not labored this long and this hard to prepare the way, only to rush prematurely through the final...
Yeda, dear Yeda, I've not labored this long and this hard either. I refuse to wait any longer for sublimation. The pain is so hard. Every day. Another month? 6 weeks? What of it? We have the encompass now. The colour, the radius. We have the components in place. We know the true centre, damn it. The looms have spun us out a lexicon that is as complete as we need. Once we transcend, all the minor details and omissions will be revealed and finished. I will not wait around for another impediment to trip us. This slight, for example, or Ravana, if, curse the emptiness, he still lives. We will go now.
I voice my objections again, Lord, Trice said.
No! No more foot-dragging. Tomorrow night, we will undertake the first enunciation. Get to work. Instigate the masses. Do what you assured me you could do.
Trice looked aside. As you decide, sir.
Orfeo,
said the Lord Governor.
Why don't you follow me up to the residence? I think it's time... You and I had a conversation.
Yes, Lord. I look forward to it.
At your leisure. My guards will show you the way.
Barazan left. Trice stared at Kalzean for a second. Kalzean simply sat down again and reached for his drink. Trice stormed out of the parlor, Revoke behind him. Layla Slade waited until Monica had left the room, too. Then she crouched down behind the sofa Kalzean was sitting on.
I really can't tell, she whispered. How's it going?
Well, Kalzean said. The bluffing stepped up a notch or two, but I think we're safe.
They bought your story about Slight?
Yes, they did.
But Slight?
Oh, it's more massive and dangerous than they can possibly imagine. But if I let them know that, they'd panic. Then we'll never get what we want. I need to control this, see it through to the end. That way, I'll get the payoff. And believe me, Lay, the payoff this time is something special.
Really? She frowned. This Enuncia thing?
More than you can possibly imagine, Layla. I'll make you a goddess.
I like the sound of that.
Are the weapons ready?
She nodded.
I've got 6 inscribed hooktors in my clip, the special ones you spent all those months preparing.
Good.
And the telluric stone. That's in a case in my pocket. There wasn't any time to prepare more than that.
Kalzean rose to his feet.
They should do, Lay. I have a few tricks myself. Let's go and take the Lord Governor up on his invitation.
Are you sure?
Yes, because he'll tell us all about Enuncia. And his Amasek has got to be a great deal better than the shit they serve down here.
The southern stack rises of Petropolis had grown so fast that they had extended out across the river bay. The lower levels of the undersink actually built up on silt-sunk piles above the water, creating a district known as the Overfloat. It was a dark and stinking catacomb down there, 48 stack levels down from surface level. The water reaches were so dark, so ancient, that eyeless albino vermin had evolved in the gloom. Effluvia pumped out from blackened spigots. Luminescent moulds sprouted from the stone piers and stanchions. A ripe flood tide of detritus sobbed in and out under the sink sumps. Kiss surfaced, gagging, and went under again. She came up, grabbed a frantic breath, then treadmilled around in the black soup, searching for Unworth. Once they'd hit the water, she'd slammed the ejector charges.
Sholto! Sholto!
Bubbles dribbled up from the sinking flyer. Kiss floundered around, her hair plastered to her face by the stinking, weed-filled water. She glanced about. There was no sign of any sheen birds. The place was dark and silent, except for the slopping of the water. And her voice.
Sholto! Mamsel!
Unworth spat the word rather than said it, as he surfaced in a flurry of bubbles.
Throne, I thought you'd drowned. I'm obligated to be about to.
Gurgled Unworth.
Can't swim.
He went under. Kiss forked her arms and splashed over to him, dragging him up, her flesh tingling from the dilute acid in the water. She towed him over to the nearest mossy brick bulwark and heaved him up onto the platform.
Unworth! Unworth!
Kiss pumped his chest and blew air into his mouth. He remained still.
Unworth!
She pounded harder and planted her lips around his, breathing out hard. He started, gagging, and she rolled him onto his side. A quantity of river filth drained out of his mouth. Coughing, spluttering, he looked up at her.
Birds, he said. Yes, bloody birds. As I concupise it, most birds can't swim, he said.
Patience Kiss realized what he had done and began to laugh. Her laughter echoed out across the dark caves of the Overfloat. Chapter 3
How's everyone doing?
Belknap asked.
Do you have any rubbing alcohol?
Frauke asked him.
Why? For the scratch on your head?
Belknap said.
No, just thirsty.
Frauke smirked, lighting a low stick. Belknap had concealed us in a lock-up over the street from the den he used as a surgery. It was a poor place, but it was out of the way. Even at this late hour, the noise from the dirty sink streets outside was loud and raucous. Drunken tavern crowds, what sounded like a gang fight in a nearby alley, a cluster of black market stalls around the oil can fires of the nearest walkthrough. Carl limped over to me. He'd bought a hand vox from one of the black market vendors on the street, and with it he had contacted Kara and Nail.
They're both on their way.
What did you tell them?
Only where to come,
he said. Neither have heard from patients. Get some rest. I was waiting near Zale. Belknap had laid the boy down on a ratty cot. Zale's eyes were still open. He had made no sound or motion since I'd found him in Carl's room. Physically he's fine, a few scratches, but he's in a fugue state, the medique said. Brought on by severe shock or trauma. Very likely, I said. Tonight has been difficult. The best thing is to leave him for a while, Belknap advised. I agreed, but in my heart I knew the good doctor was wrong. The best thing, the safest thing, would be to execute Zale Eternity right now, while he was comatose. There was a high likelihood that Zale had manifested slight during the psyker attack, that the warp latency in his mind had been provoked into action by the assault. I'd seen that before, individuals suddenly displaying previously unknown psi powers under extremis. Caught in the teeth of three or four murderous psykers, Zale's fragile sanity had snapped, and something else had come out. And what a thing. Even newborn, it had destroyed perhaps three of the psykers. It had also, I was quite sure, playfully linked its power to mine and assisted with the destruction of the brass thief. That was where my almost mindless rage had come from. The divine frattery had spent years preparing the way for the demon slight. My master Eisenhorn had trekked across the sector to warn me. Slight was an abominable threat to Imperial security, and I, or one of those about me, would bring it forth. I knew I should just kill Zale right then, before he woke. But I had good reasons not to. Not just yet. The first, the most human, was that I did not relish murdering a boy in his sleep, especially as I had only circumstantial evidence he was corrupted. There was still a slender chance he was innocent. Secondly, I could detect no trace of the warp upon him, except for the foggy latency of his far-seeing gift. And that was the third reason. Zale's unformed talent was so rare and so passive. A mirror-seer. A reactor. That was precisely why I hadn't executed him or consigned him to the black ships the day I discovered him. His nascent talent was a precious thing, one that could benefit the Imperium of Mankind so very much. And it was not an active talent. It seemed so unlikely that a passive gift could be the womb, the cradle of a manifesting demon. Such things inevitably came into our world through minds twisted by madness, greed, psychosis, or potent, active psychic power. Like mine, for instance. With his name, and his odd, disarming manner, and his sometimes troubling gift, Zale Eternity was so obviously the threat. Too obviously. I would stay my hand until I had the opportunity to study him further, if I got that chance. I owed Zale the benefit of the doubt. And, of course, there was the fourth reason. If Slight was lurking beneath the surface of the comatose boy's mind, if Slight was anything like as powerful as I had been led to believe, putting a weapon to Zale's head would be a very, very bad idea. It might be the hasty action that caused the demon to manifest permanently. For now, Zale slept. And if Slight was sleeping inside him, then at least Slight was sleeping. Sir, it was Carl, some good news at last. Nail just called to say he's been contacted by patients. She was calling from a public vox in Formal L.
Formal L?
There's a story to it, apparently. She's fine, though her powers are temporarily inhibited, which is why you couldn't find her. She's on her way here. Apparently she's got some important information for us.
Enantia, Patience Kiss said.
There was a moment's pause.
Are you sure? I asked.
I followed that bastard Moloch all the way to Zenta Malhide when he was looking for it. He never told me much or shared any of what he had learned, but I know the taste of it, the smell of it. Trice's ministry is engaged in the production of a working grammar for Enantia.
It was a staggering thought, but it made sense of many things.
I believe they're processing one piece at a time, said Kiss, one morpheme at a time. They're not deciphering it from some archaeological cache or ancient text. They're weaving it from our own known language bases.
You mean randomly? Phonius asked, doubtful. Kiss nodded.
Yes. They're taking raw language, raw symbols, alphabet characters, scripts, syllables, numerals, number bases, etymons and word roots, syntax and grammar structures, and they're breaking it right down to the smallest units.